6:40 past the hour. This is Faith Radio. I'm Bill Meyer. This Sunday, we mark the 15th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. And joining us to take a look back at that event and the current state of our national defense is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood. He's Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Dakota.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on. Good to be with you.
So let's go back to September 11th, 2001. You were an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. Where were you stationed at the time? And let me ask you, what are your personal memories of that particular day?
Yeah, actually, I was stationed at the Pentagon, which was hit. And I had arrived at the office, the A ring, which is the center ring right there. I was the Marine Corps assistant to a director of a particular analytic office. We worked for the Secretary of Defense. And we actually had a meeting to attend outside the building. So I had escorted him out of the building to downtown D.C. And about 15 minutes into the building, we were informed that something had happened at the Pentagon. All the major buildings in D.C. were being evacuated. A lot of uncertainty, rumors of multiple aircraft in the air. Certainly, New York had already happened. And so my director, who had, was 80 years old at the time, brilliant guy, I escorted him home, lived over in the Watergate area. We walked through D.C. to his place. And then I and about 10,000 other people actually had to walk out of Washington, D.C. and find our way back home. So my car was in the south parking lot of the Pentagon, couldn't get to it, and made it home. My wife picked me up at a subway station, and we watched the news the rest of the afternoon. And the next morning, I walked back into the Pentagon and stepping over fire hoses and debris and everything else. So it was a pretty interesting day.
Now, did you know anyone? Obviously, the Pentagon is a huge place, but did you know anyone or did you have any relationship with anyone who was either injured or killed on that day at the Pentagon?
Indirectly. I had some good friends who worked either in the Navy Intelligence or Operations Center who had either been late arriving to work that morning and leaving their car in the parking lot, walking toward the building, saw the plane come in, and certainly all those spaces were decimated. So they had colleagues, friends that they were working with who were killed in that attack. And then an office that I had worked in just a few months prior was right above where the nose of the plane ended up penetrating into, about the third ring. And some of my colleagues there were able to rush into the smoke and debris and help rescue people. So for me, it was an indirect experience. The stories that came out of that were just inspiring because of the personal courage that was shown by the people directly involved, and also horrifying, clearly, with the deaths of the innocent people at the hands of terrorists.
I recall a couple years ago, I was at a chapel service, and the speaker was an officer who was severely burned in that attack. I can't recall his name right now, but was disfigured and talked about his own experiences as the plane hit and the fire erupted and losing close friends, losing colleagues there in the Pentagon. Such a tragedy. Do we know, and I know there's been speculation about this, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, do we have any clear evidence all these years later that it was either going to be targeting the Capitol or the White House?
That detail, I think, is still unknown, but clearly it's a trajectory of the flight path that it was on that the FAA was able to reconstruct. Those computers were following that, even though the plane itself had been taken down into the field by the passengers, was heading for Washington, D.C. proper. And I would encourage your listeners, if they haven't already, on PBS. They've just aired a documentary, I'm sure it'll be repeated, called Inside the Pentagon, that goes through the hours leading up to the attack, what occurred at the Pentagon, and then in the immediate aftermath. And it talks about identifying structures in D.C. The White House is very small, not many people in the Capitol building on an early morning session like that. So the Pentagon, very visible, very large, easy to hit, if that's what you're trying to do. So there's a lot of conjecture that they were probably aiming for the Pentagon, just like they had the two other planes in New York hitting the Twin Towers.
Mm. Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation, as we take a look back at 9/11. Stick with us here on Faith Radio. At 7:47, this is the Faith Radio Network. This Sunday is the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. We were just reliving Dakota's own experiences being stationed at the Pentagon on 9/11. So, Dakota, what happened to you in the weeks and months immediately following the terrorist attacks?
Getting our own office back into order again, supported the Secretary of Defense with some strategic analysis, but having close associates in another similar group supporting the Commandant of the Marine Corps, I knew that our operations center was going to be on a wartime footing. So I got leave from my director to support Marine Corps' senior level planning and responses to National Command Authority requests for what the Corps could actually provide in responding to the situation. So we did that for about 10 days or so. And then U.S. Central Command Headquarters put out a call for senior-level planners with certain security clearances and credentials. And I was just one of a couple guys in the Marine Corps that had that. So I was dispatched to Central Command and worked there for 6 months. And we did the planning and operations of the U.S. response into Afghanistan to go after Al-Qaeda, cutting through the Taliban to get there. So I was part of the planning team at CENTCOM for operations into Afghanistan for the six months following the attacks of 9/11.
You were involved in both Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Describe the mission of those two particular combat operations.
So the one into Afghanistan during Freedom was very interesting. It started off special operations heavy. We put people in that worked with the Northern Alliance. It was kind of a loose collection of rebel groups, et cetera, warlords in northern Afghanistan, and also established relationships with similar kinds of organizations in the south. And they brought that coalition together to defeat the Taliban, which enabled a special operations heavy attack vector into Al-Qaeda camps. Over the months, though, that greatly expanded into more of a conventional fight, conventional Army units, conventional Air Force attack aircraft supporting that. And I think we've seen the consequences of that. I disagreed with that decision. I thought it should have been Special Forces-centric, but history is what it is. Sometime later, then, the road to war in Iraq with what Saddam Hussein was doing, the intel community reporting on weapons of mass destruction programs, and chemical, biological, and a nascent nuclear program. It seemed to the administration back then at that time that it was an opportune moment to remove Saddam Hussein from power. So there was a buildup in December and January in Kuwait. I was dispatched over to Kuwait to help stand up the Marine Corps forces there. And then in the spring, crossed the line into Iraq, and it was a conventional combined arms military operation to defeat the military force under Saddam Hussein and then remove him from office there in Baghdad. So that was the spring of 2003.
I'm trying to recall, when did Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait? Was that after 9/11? I'm trying to get my sequence right here.
Yeah, that was actually a decade prior. When he went into Kuwait, that was in August of 1990. And the U.S. responded with Operation Desert Shield and building up a defensive force to protect Saudi Arabia and the oil fields and all that stuff. And combat power was built up under George H.W. Bush with an international coalition of forces. I actually got over there just about a week or so after combat operation stopped for that one. And the force went from Saudi Arabia up into Kuwait and ejected Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. But the mandate did not extend to chasing those forces further into Iraq or deposing Saddam Hussein. All that desert storm occurred, the combat phase occurred in the spring of 1991. So you roll forward a decade to 2003, and that was Operation Iraqi Freedom that deposed Saddam Hussein about 18 months or so after the terror attacks of 9/11.
Mm. So let me get your perspective, Dakota, on the current status of our national security and the proliferation of terrorist groups in various hotspots around the world. And I realize it's a very complicated situation, both politically and militarily. But do you believe, this is your opinion here, do you believe there are actions that the U.S. could have taken during the past 8 years that would have limited the rise of groups like ISIS?
I think so. I mean, you know, you've heard the cancer analogy, I'm sure, countless times, but I think it's a very apt analogy in that when cancer is detected in a body, the one thing you don't do is treat it gingerly, right? I mean, you don't take kind of half steps and minimal measures out of fear of causing harm to the other parts of the body. You have to go in aggressively with treatment, either cutting it out, killing it with chemo or radiation or some other kind of treatment. So that the cancer doesn't metastasize and spread throughout the body. Because when that happens, even if you go after the original source, it's too late. You know, other body parts and organs are compromised, and you have a much worse problem. So I think that's a great analogy for the terror situation that we see, that if we look at the Islamic State or ISIS right now in Syria and Iraq, if the U.S. had acted more aggressively, if we had maintained a presence in Iraq to keep conditions from evolving that were favorable to the rise of these very violent terror groups, then we wouldn't have the problem we have today, where the Islamic State is not just Syria, even though it's lost ground there, but it's now metastasized, and there are reports that it has some sort of presence or affiliates in more than 20 other countries around the world. So it's in Yemen, it's in Afghanistan, you've seen terror attacks throughout major cities in Europe, it's all over the place in northern Africa, and there have been fairly recent reports, although extending back some years in totality, of affiliates going up through Latin America and potentially up into the United States itself. So this terror element, because the United States has taken half steps and half measures, has created fertile soil or an opportunity for these very aggressive, confident, provocative terror groups like the Islamic State or Boko Haram or others, or even Al-Qaeda, to take root in places and to spread their ideology. And people in that part of the world want to be on what they view as a winning team, you know, a confident team, somebody that's doing the will of their God, so to speak. And so it draws adherence. You know, people want to rally to that flag because they see that flag being planted in many other locations around the world. So I think our policy of restraint in many ways, that doesn't mean you're invading every country, but you have to act confidently, aggressively, and you can't half-step because the message is, oh, the United States is involved, but they're not being effective, therefore the U.S. is weak, and people are emboldened to be more aggressive than they would be otherwise.
That's certainly what we've seen. We just got about a minute and a half left. Let me ask you this. We have a presidential election coming up in 60 days. Other than terrorism, what are the biggest military threats that our next president is going to need to deal with?
Well, it's ones you've heard before. I mean, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and China. And why is that the case? It's because their robustness and their ability to intimidate or to deter action from others in their neighborhood, Europeans for Russia, Asia powers for China, they're creeping out and expanding their sphere of influence, which in the strategic sense is not in the United States' interest. So where you have very provocative, again, aggressive, developing ballistic missile technologies in North Korea, you've got an Iran that's bent on acquiring its own nuclear capabilities. I mean, these are very deeply rooted, profound, long-term consequence kinds of strategic challenges. And they will only be deterred if the United States maintains its own strong capability and acts confidently in the world.
Mm. You can learn more about the work of the Heritage Foundation, their involvement in defense issues, by going to the Heritage Foundation's website, heritage.org. Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, thank you so much for your time this morning, sir, and thank you for your service to our country.
My pleasure. Thank you.